This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, top experts, 28 minutes and a big issue of the day. Let's go. And this week, head for the Straits of Taiwan, that stretch of water separating the island of Taiwan from its giant neighbour China, which thinks it should own Taiwan. Could these tensions lead to war? Imagine, you've just won a gold medal at the Olympics and in your delight, you dedicate your win to your country. That would be okay, wouldn't it? Not if you're from Taiwan and have just beaten China in the final, as happened in the men's badminton doubles in Tokyo. The Chinese were less than pleased because China does not recognise Taiwan as a country, but as a renegade province which will sooner or later return or be returned to the fold. That's why the International Olympic Committee, to everyone's confusion, calls Taiwan Chinese Taipei. And why some people in the region are worried that an increasingly self-confident China might one day soon use its new military might to take what it regards as its own, drawing the US and others into a dangerous conflict. So is that likely? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Taiwan is an anomaly. It has an ambiguous international status. For decades, the authorities in Beijing have argued that Taiwan belongs to them. But calls inside Taiwan for full independence have been growing, while the United States says it is committed to preserving the status quo and preventing any coercion from China. To understand how we've got to this point, we need a history lesson. In the briefing room is Margaret Hillenbrand, Associate Professor of Modern Chinese Culture and Literature at the University of Oxford.
The island was mostly inhabited by indigenous peoples until the 1600s. But during that century, it was colonised by the Dutch and by the Spanish until it was brought under the control of the Chinese Qing Dynasty in 1683. And then over the next 300 years, Taiwan experienced multiple waves of immigration from China's eastern seaboard provinces. And then Taiwan was made an official province of China in 1885. But only 10 years later, it was ceded to Japan after China's defeat in the First Sino-Japanese War. And it was subjected to pretty intense policies of cultural and linguistic assimilation until 1945, when it was returned to China at the end of the Pacific War.
By the autumn of 1949, the communists had driven the nationalists out of all the major cities.
When Mao Zedong and the communists triumphed in China's civil war on the mainland, Chiang Kai-shek and his followers in the Nationalist Party retreated to Taiwan. Taiwan's retrocession to China wasn't exactly an ecstatic embrace. There were several severe tensions between locals and the newcomers from the mainland, and these culminated in the so-called February 28th incident of 1947, when you get serious civil unrest breaking out. And the government crackdown, which then followed, is still the subject of quite intense debate today. Estimates of the death toll range from a sort of implausibly low 500 to an upper limit of tens of thousands of victims. The leaders of the protest movement were the supposed targets, but countless prominent Taiwanese were rounded up and executed. And these killings, which were then hushed up for decades, they call it their orphan consciousness, a humiliating sense of having been passed around like a prize between bigger powers. And over the next 20 years, social energies were diverted away from politics and channeled towards economic growth. And this goal of growth was achieved in pretty spectacular fashion, really, as Taiwan transformed itself from a rural backwater into a first-tier Asian economy. But as the years passed, this miracle, the Taiwan miracle, began to force movement in the political sphere, and a new middle class emerges and begins to search for a political identity. And this was a quest which coincided crucially with severe setbacks to Taiwan's international status. Taiwan has been viewed in very complex and shifting ways by the international community and above all by the US. Taiwan became a crucial node in the US strategy for communist containment, the Pax Americana, and successive administrations poured money into the island via what was essentially a mini Marshall Plan of economic aid plus military provisioning.
Chinese nationalist troops parading on Formosa before Chiang Kai-shek remind the world that although this offshore island is all the territory that remains to the man who once ruled the most populated nation on Earth, he has never given up hope of wresting China back from communist rule. Equipped with the latest American arms.
And this situation continues until the early 1970s, when the US under Nixon began to pursue serious rapprochement with China. Taiwan was then expelled from the UN in 1971. Its seat was transferred to China. And this basically leaves Taiwan marooned. And then in 1978, Jimmy Carter abandoned official diplomatic relations with Taipei, recognizing Beijing instead. Taiwan's status is a very difficult question. And by most standard determinants, I think you'd have to say that Taiwan qualifies as a nation state. It has territorial jurisdiction, its own elected president and parliament. It has its own military and foreign relations, its own passport even. But it currently has full diplomatic relations with only 14 of the, I think, 193 United Nations member states. China's economic rise has allowed it to pick off more and more of the holdouts who support Taiwan diplomatically. What this has ended up in is really an awkward, kind of an absurd situation, really. So you get Taiwan being the home of one of the great 20th century economic miracles. It now has one of the most lively, most vigorous democracies in the world. It became the first country in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage in 2019. And its early stage management of COVID won it a lot of global admiration. But despite all of this, Taiwan remains not a pariah, but effectively unrecognized on the global stage. In the conversations that I've had with Chinese people, children are taught in schools from a very early age that Taiwan is an inseparable part of China. But at the same time, they visit the island in huge numbers every year, and they're attracted by everything from Taiwan's superb food to its exuberant political rallies to the displays of democracy that they can't actually see at home.
Margaret Hillenbrand. The current Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, has overseen a more assertive domestic and foreign policy, including the crushing of dissent in Hong Kong. So just what is Beijing's current thinking when it comes to Taiwan? Joining me in the briefing room is Dr. Yu Jie, Senior Research Fellow on China in the Asia-Pacific Programme at Chatham House. Dr. Yu, what is Xi Jinping's approach to Taiwan? Is it any different to that of his predecessors?
Well, there are some differences regarding President Xi Jinping's approach towards Taiwan. I mean, the first difference is he tried very hard to dismantle Taiwan's international diplomatic ties with several Central American countries and also African countries. I mean, for most notoriously example would be Panama back to 2017, left Taiwan and turned into Beijing. Now, second difference is in the past, it seems the Chinese leadership always take this measure that using economic inducement to maintain the status quo on the current cross-strait relations. But however, under Xi Jinping, there's a military build-up, there's more frequent exercises from the People's Liberation Army around Taiwan Strait. Now, I think over medium term, that part of the so-called China dream about the reunification of Taiwan, but whether by peaceful means or by other means, we don't know at this stage. But I think that's over medium term, that is what Xi Jinping has in mind.
Do you mean to say that you think that Xi Jinping thinks it's a realistic objective that under his leadership, China and Taiwan might be reunified?
Well, it was his estimation, I think, back to the early 2019, judging by the speech he made. So he was very optimistic about it, and he would be able to reunify Taiwan. But having said that, given what had happened within Hong Kong, you know, obviously the Taiwanese make a judgment regarding the one country, two systems, and this perhaps further strengthened the hand of the pro-independence parts of Taiwan and prefer to be departed away from Beijing.
Would his calculation be that the possibility of reunification has receded because of Hong Kong or has come closer?
Well, it's very hard to judge. I mean, on the one hand, this entire thing is not really depends on China. It also depends on how America respond. It is also depends on the domestic politics of Taiwan as well. So it is not entirely up to China to decide what is the current status. And I think secondly, it is also judging by the domestic economic situation of China and how closely the two economies are intertwined. For example, Taiwan is taking 80% of semiconductor production all over the world, and China is a big customer for semiconductor. So whether to take a military means to take over Taiwan would jeopardize China's economic condition as well. So I think there's several calculations the leadership in Beijing will have to think very carefully.
What other forms of significant pressure can China use in order to try and ensure, firstly, that Taiwan doesn't seek formal independence, and secondly, to move it towards reunification?
I think it's more likely on the economic terms, because the two sides, both Taipei and Beijing, are closely intertwined economically. So there's also emotional ties from Taiwan as well. There are still generations of people who are in power, had very close tie with Beijing in the past. So I think these two elements make the both sides have to think very carefully.
We've heard already that Chinese schoolchildren are taught that Taiwan is a natural part of China. Do you think that builds up an expectation amongst Chinese people that there will be a push on reunification? Or do they tend to see this as just another aspect of what the regime tells the people?
Taiwan is a major element of that patriotic education, and they would prefer to have reunification. But at what cost and at what means? Judging by the speech made by Xi Jinping in the party centenary last month, it seems to be that the leadership considering a medium-term prospect of a reunification rather than a shorter term.
I'm going to ask you that dread question. What are we talking about in terms of years when we talk about the medium term, roughly?
50 years. That's what I mean by medium terms. By the time when China become the so-called middle to high-level income country club, I think that's the ultimate goal Xi Jinping wants to have as a part of his China dream. But then another element, obviously, is the national reunification.
So that's quite interesting, because that obviously goes beyond the lifetimes of the current leadership in Beijing or indeed in Taiwan.
It absolutely does. That's why we're talking about in medium term.
I've now realised that what Chinese call the medium term is what I tend to call the long term, which is interesting. Now, let's talk about the circumstances under which things could become more difficult. Because what you've described, I think, seems to suggest that the Chinese will be quite careful. But at the same time, there are these kind of rather belligerent manoeuvres. What are we to take from the contradiction between those two things?
Well, I think there are several different contradictions. Like in any Chinese foreign policy or domestic policy formation, there are different views within the party, obviously from the People's Liberation Army point of view, that taking Taiwan by force seems to be a viable option. But then on the other hand, you also have a very strong economic and business community considering perhaps the current status quo, it is at the best for the business environment. Now, for President Xi, and he will have to tread very carefully not to jeopardize the interest of either side. So sometimes he's sitting on almost an impossible situation. That's one thing. Now, another thing which I'm really worried is about the younger generation from Taiwan that has less emotional ties with mainland China. So that's another danger in here. Perhaps the current status quo, it is not sustainable.
So in other words, something might happen in Taiwan that could upset the apple cart.
I think something has already upset Beijing because of the current pro-independent presence in office in the past few years. So yes, they're moving towards dangerous trend, I would say.
Yu Jie analysing the Chinese position. But what is the view from Taiwan? In the briefing room now is J. Michael Cole, who is based in Taipei and is senior fellow with the Taiwan Studies Program at Nottingham University. J. Michael Cole, what do the Taiwanese feel about the mainland?
Well, for the great majority of Taiwanese, there is a recognition that the People's Republic of China does exist. They do not deny its existence or legitimacy. But at the same time, for a very large number of people in Taiwan, there's also the recognition that this is not only a foreign country, but also a country that is at least currently ruled by a regime whose values are quite different from the liberal democracy that the Taiwanese have embraced and cultivated in the past two or three decades. So there's this mismatch of ideology and systems and values as well that makes the People's Republic of China truly unappealing as a model for the Taiwanese, and certainly not something that they're interested in becoming part of. This is even more pronounced among younger Taiwanese. Recent developments in Hong Kong have only underscored the differences in the systems of governance on the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. Now, that does not mean that Taiwanese are not willing to go study in China or do business in China. Several of them do. But under no circumstances does this mean that for them it signifies that they are indeed citizens of the People's Republic of China or would be willing to become so.
Now, we've seen because of the Olympics, the formulation which the International Olympic Committee has been forced to use, which is to call what we call Taiwan Chinese Taipei. And this brings up the question of whether or not Taiwan should seek formal independence under its own name. What is the government in Taiwan's current position with regard to seeking independence?
They've already stated repeatedly there is no need to declare independence because Taiwan is already independent, whose official name is the Republic of China. This is the area where the government in Taipei has sought to engage their counterparts in Beijing. This is not working very well because the Chinese side truly insists on what it calls the One China principle and that Taiwan is part of China. But once again, this clashes against the 23.5 million people who elected the government in Taiwan, who are very clear that the defense of their liberal democratic way of life is non-negotiable. And to that, we add the full recognition by the great majority of people here in Taiwan that the protection of liberal democratic system is not something that can be achieved following unification with China. The one thing that truly affects stated preferences on independence versus status quo is the fact that the Chinese regime has repeatedly made it very clear that if the Taiwanese were to declare independence, that would result in the Chinese resorting to force to annex Taiwan. So the Taiwanese, being pragmatic as they are, they recognize that under current circumstances, they already have the ability to operate as citizens in a, you know, for all intents and purposes, is a sovereign state, but also recognition that they need to be careful not to provoke China into launching what would inevitably be a devastating attack against Taiwan and potentially other countries in the region who might come to Taiwan's defense.
How much do the Taiwanese fear that such an attack might happen anyway?
The rhetoric coming from China threatening use of force against Taiwan is nothing new. It's gotten more strident and pronounced in recent years, particularly since the emergence of Xi Jinping in late 2012. Now, there is, in many circles, the assumption that when push comes to shove, the regime in Beijing would act rationally and it would calculate the costs versus benefits of launching war against Taiwan, and then would move away from that kind of behavior against Taiwan. Now, the problem with that, and as you just pointed out, there is this rising ultra-nationalistic sentiment in China that could lead to a bottom-up influence on decision-makers. The other variable as well is that we are dealing with a deeply authoritarian regime in Beijing that is very much centered on a single individual, which means that there is a high likelihood that Xi Jinping is not receiving the kind of intelligence and advice that he needs to make enlightened decisions when it comes to matters of war and peace in the Taiwan Strait. Another big question as well is domestic conditions in China. Oftentimes very difficult to know what is going on. But if the situation were such that the ability of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing were threatened due to domestic instability, it is not impossible that the regime in Beijing could decide to launch an attack against Taiwan to externalize or to refocus anxieties and anger in China by focusing on an external enemy. And Taiwan certainly is a highly emotional object or subject for Chinese nationalists.
In that eventuality, however we calculate its likelihood, what would be the chances of Taiwan being able to defend itself?
Well, on its own, Taiwan would only be able to promise its ability to inflict rather serious damage on assaulting Chinese units, but it would not have the ability to withstand a prolonged, sustained attack by the Chinese over several weeks. The chief object of Taiwan's defense posture is one of deterrence, what they oftentimes refer to as a porcupine strategy, basically meaning that if you attack Taiwan, the sting is going to be such that it's not worth the effort. And to that, obviously, we must add the great role that allies of Taiwan, such as the United States, but increasingly countries like Japan, also contribute to Taiwan's deterrence by basically forcing Beijing to realize that it would not only be fighting Taiwan, but would also be confronted to an alliance in East Asia involving the Americans and the Japanese.
J. Michael Cole. The other big power involved in the mix is, of course, the United States, long a guarantor of Taiwan's status. To explain America's stance, I'm joined in the briefing room by Bonnie Glaser, director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States in Washington, D.C. Bonnie Glaser, let's get one thing established first. What is the formal relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan?
It is complicated. It basically, Congress decided Taiwan shall be treated as a non-NATO ally without the formal designation as such. So there's nothing more complicated for the United States than our relationship with Taiwan. So there's no easy answer.
Right. The U.S., I think, has a commitment to help Taiwan defend itself. I mean, how far does that commitment go?
The United States does not have an obligation to come to Taiwan's defense if it were attacked. And it did have that obligation when the U.S. and Taiwan had a mutual defense treaty. And then after the United States established diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China, the U.S. put in place the Taiwan Relations Act, known as the TRA. And that's the law that's guided the U.S. unofficial relationship with Taiwan since diplomatic ties with Taiwan were broken. The United States is required under the TRA to sell arms to Taiwan to enable the island to defend itself. And if a major threat to Taiwan were to occur, the president must inform Congress and collectively determine how the U.S. should respond. So that's the language of the Taiwan Relations Act. And it also states, interestingly, that it is the policy of the United States to maintain a capacity to resist the use of force or coercion against Taiwan. But that language is a bit weaker than the language used regarding arms sales.
Let's imagine some terrible disaster and actually China does
attack Taiwan. Do you believe that the US would ever be prepared to go to war with China over Taiwan?
I believe that under most circumstances, the United States would come to Taiwan's defense. And in doing so, it would be prepared to engage in a major military conflict with China. And since the passage of the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, there have been several developments that have greatly increased the likelihood that the U.S. would defend Taiwan if attacked. First was the transformation of Taiwan from an authoritarian government to a democracy, and that began in the late 80s. So the United States now shares values with Taiwan. And that's a factor, I think, that would enter into U.S. decision-making. Secondly, and this is, of course, more recent, is the intensifying competition between the United States and China, and the U.S. assessment that China basically poses unacceptable threats to U.S. interests. And that has, I think, increased the likelihood that the U.S. would come to Taiwan's defense if it were attacked. And then thirdly, the U.S. is aware that a failure to respond and defend Taiwan would result in doubts in other countries about whether the United States is in fact a reliable ally. I think this is especially true in Japan, and it would weaken the U.S. leadership role in the region. So I think for those reasons, the United States is quite likely to come to Taiwan's defense. I would add that there's maybe one scenario in which U.S. military support might not be forthcoming or might be limited. And that is if a government in Taiwan declared independence, ignoring U.S. warnings not to do so.
It's very interesting that you mentioned Japan earlier, because for a long time, I don't recall many people talking about Japanese foreign policy. And yet now we have begun to have noises out of Japan about Taiwan. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think Japan has long viewed the potential takeover of Taiwan by China as a threat to its security. But Japanese officials have talked very little about this publicly. And in recent months, there have been public expressions about the growing Chinese military threat to Japan and the stability of Taiwan. And this is really unprecedented. We just saw the Japanese Defense White Paper come out a few weeks ago, and it stated for the first time that the stability of Taiwan is important for Japanese interests. We also heard comments from their defense minister and their deputy prime minister saying essentially that a problem in Taiwan could be related to the survival of Japan. And that language suggests that such a scenario could justify Japan exercising what we call its right of collective self-defense and use force, not only to defend Japan, but also to defend Taiwan and work closely with the United States. But my view is that such statements by Japan will probably make China less likely to use force against Taiwan. So at the end of the day, it may strengthen deterrence, and I think that's the outcome we want to see.
That sounds as if your view of what the US wants is essentially the status quo. It doesn't want the Taiwanese government to declare independence because that makes Chinese action more likely, and it's pretty happy to continue as things are as long as the Chinese restrain themselves.
Yes, I think the United States does support the continuation of the status quo. Of course, that means it is somewhat unstable. Our definition of the status quo in the United States is that Taiwan is not a sovereign independent state. Taiwan's definition of the status quo is that it is a sovereign independent state. And of course, China's definition of the status quo is that Taiwan is part of China and needs to be reintegrated with China. So the three sides have very different definitions. But the United States policy says that there should be no unilateral change in the status quo. And that is a message both to Taipei as well as to Beijing, that they should not take actions that would cause the other, if it's in the case of China, to attack, or if China took actions to change the status quo as well. So the U.S. opposes both sides changing the status quo.
Bonnie Glaser, my conclusion from all that is that in the short term and what we call the medium term, we're probably safe from a war over Taiwan. But let's be careful out there. My thanks to Bonnie Glaser, to Margaret Hillenbrand, Yu Jie, and J. Michael Cole. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirsty Knight, Jim Frank and Ben Carter. The sound was mixed by Graham Puddifoot and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've asked, where have all the workers gone in the UK? How much will COP26 help tackle climate change? And what has altered about how we decide to vote?
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.